Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Tuesday. This is Renee. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. Well, as you know, the rest of October, we're going to do a lot of discussion about the repercussions and the ongoing effect of bullying. Interestingly enough, this latest episode with the young girl, Rebecca, that we talked about last week, who took her own life in the beginning of September due to 15 girls bullying her on a regular basis. It's now come to light, and we talked about this as well. I mentioned the fact that we know that two girls gave themselves up, and one of them said she didn't care that Rebecca took her own life and used some pretty heavy-duty profanity describing it on her text or her Facebook comment. I guess all of the above. So last night when I was doing some research, I found out that the mom, the stepmother of this young woman who was one of the main bulliers in this attack on this young girl, Rebecca, is bullied at home as well. And if you'll recall, we talked about that a little bit. We talked about the fact that it's very possible and quite often true that people that are abusive to other people outside the home and have trouble making friends unless it's a unless it's like a follow the leader kind of mentality where their meanness entices other people to follow them because they're feeling frustrated and angry as well. So it turns out that this young girl, her mother, her stepmother, has been arrested and has been witnessed, according to the articles that I read last night, punching kids in a group of 9 to 14-year-olds. There's no explanation for why or where or what brought any of this about, just the fact that witnesses, I guess, turned her in. And indeed, she was arrested. And, of course, the mugshot that I saw was very unflattering, albeit I've never seen a real flattering mugshot. Even our famous movie stars look pretty bad when they have a mugshot taken. So be that as it may, apparently there's a history of this young girl being abused by this stepmother. So it kind of opens up that door for us to think about that some more. And of course, we're all familiar with the snowball effect, the domino effect, the repercussions from everyone's actions. Often not only our own. We know, I'm sure, you can all think of off the top of your head several occasions when you've done one thoughtless or unplanned action, and that action has created a snowball effect and gotten way out of control. Sometimes it's only a word. Sometimes it's one word taken out of context, and you start this tremendous ball rolling. And the trouble with balls like that is they knock over everybody in their way. And they usually create more harm than good. So here we have, in some cases, according to some of the stuff I've read of late, and some of the things that I know personally, in many families, there's a frustration or an anger that starts with one and spreads like chicken pox to the rest of the family and goes on to infect everybody in the wake of this family. So in order to really get a handle on what's going on in the outside world and in the schools particularly, we have to do something about what's going on privately. Now, we've talked at length about how families, kids in particular, don't share stuff like this. There's a multitude of reasons. If you've never listened to the show before, or if you've never looked into anything like this before, it may surprise you to know that a child, especially a relatively young child, more often than not, keeps these things a big secret. Very unusual for them to share with authoritative figures in their life anything about their home life, their parents in particular, because they still love them, regardless of what's going on. Now, I don't know that that's the case with a stepmother scenario. It could be, and it also could not be. But it also could be that in an attempt to tell somebody, nobody listened. So then what happens is we get an acting out from all the pressure and all of the fear, for one thing, fear that something's going to happen to you. So you almost have instinctually go out and be mean to other people before somebody else has the opportunity to be mean to you. Now, in the world of adults, that sounds silly, and it sounds like what a waste of time. And yet we are guilty of those same actions. We start out a day by having an argument with our spouse and go into our workplace, and it continues on for the rest of the day. Unless you are one of those kind of people who sees or understands exactly what's taking place and does something about it, changes it before it snowballs into a much bigger problem. It would be my hope that we could all do that, but it is kind of unrealistic. For one thing, we're really not trained or programmed to, recalculate after something bad happens to us. We tend to fret it, worry about it, reevaluate what happened, why it happened, whether it was our fault, whether it didn't have anything to do with us. It's sometimes in minutes, all these emotions go through our head, trying to figure out why. Say you're 11, and mom and dad are having money problems or marital problems or whatever. You don't know. You're just a kid. You just know that there's some disharmony, some friction going on in your house. You get up in the morning, and you say the wrong thing to mom, and you get smacked. Mom doesn't usually smack you out of the blue. You're upset by it. You have to go to school. What are the repercussions that happen in a day like that? And those things happen every day, every minute of every day. And a lot of times there's no hatred. There's no malicious intent. It's just an action or a reaction to something that's already happened. So when we talk about these young kids that are bullying, that are doing even verbally bullying, cyberbullying, all the things that we talked about yesterday, the laws that people are putting into effect in regard to cyberbullying, I read on, I belong to a group from a place that I lived a long time in upstate New York. And most of the time, this is a lovely, platonic group. Everybody talks about the old swimming holes, the old restaurants, the old neighborhood bars, the old neighborhood mom-and-pop markets. And it's wonderful. It's also a college town, and people reminisce about college town and some of the old neighborhoods and everything. And yet every now and then, somebody will get on this page, and you have to be either invited in or you have to be recommended to join this group. And somebody will come in, and they start talking trash. They try to ruin the whole site for everybody. They talk about people that are long gone. They actually defame people that are long gone from something that obviously happened between them and that person and they never got over. Why? What's the purpose of that? How does that serve you? It certainly doesn't serve the person that's no longer here to protect themselves or give the other side of the story. And yet, and these people, most of these people, I'm going to guess, are average age 50, older than me, considerably younger than me, a lifetime of memories for people. And it's a beautiful thing until somebody steps onto the site and says something, I don't know, just unthinking, uncaring, and in some cases even malicious. And these are grown-ups. These aren't teenagers. So the fact that teenagers can do that, and kids that haven't suffered the repercussions of their actions maybe enough or yet or whatever, say things that are, first of all, not necessary. And second of all, will hurt somebody somewhere, somehow. There has to be more thought. There has to be more consideration of other people's feelings. Now, the reason I wanted to bring up this story of the stepmother is not to ostracize this one stepmother. It's very possible that this is a one-time thing. As you know, when you read things in the media or online, you're only getting the part of the story that is the most outrageous and the most entertaining. We get that. I'm sure we all get that. But whenever you hear anything, you know someplace in there, there's a seed of truth. The embellishment and the retelling of a story often changes it drastically. If you're over the age of 25, I'm sure you realize this. So now we're talking about another young person, a child, a 14-year-old who has very possibly, at age 14, ruined their life. They didn't take their life. They're not the one that jumped off the building. They're not the one that's gone forever. But they've changed their life to a point that it will never be whatever it was supposed to be. Now it's altered. And it's altered because of their own actions. So on top of living with that alteration and that change in paths and that reputation, if you will, that they get to live with the rest of their lives, they also get to make do with it. They also have to make it work now. They have a whole life in front of them. This is not an easy road. If you're a kid, and you're out there and you're listening this morning online or you listen later in the day, if you click on this show just to see what it's about out of curiosity, understand that everything you do has lasting effects. Remnants of all your actions often stay with you the rest of your life. Some of them are great. Some of them are wonderful remnants, feelings of love and being cared for, happiness, 16th birthday parties. There's a whole slew of memories that can stay with you that are beautiful. But the memories that you make when you make bad choices, they don't go away. They stay with you. And they often cause internal scars that never, ever, ever completely go away. You can cover them with makeup. You'll excuse the pun, to cover up a scar so that you don't see it anymore. Doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean it's gone. At the end of the day, when you take your shower, the makeup's gone, and you're still left with the same scar. It's the same thing with internal scarring. It's the same thing with old memories that hurt you because perhaps you hurt someone else. You need to think about these things. And I think in the world of bullying, in the world of unkindness and how we treat each other, we have got to give some careful consideration to how we treat others, because it comes back to us. Life is a circle. You all know that. We've all talked about the circle of life. We've all talked about the continuum of how things go around and around and around. So eventually, your stuff comes back to you. So you have to treat the world accordingly. You have to abide by the golden rule. You have to treat others as you would like them to treat you. If you don't, it will always be a difficult, difficult journey. Now let me be clear about something. If you are doing the best you can and treating people the best you know how, it doesn't mean bad stuff won't come around to you. I wish I could say that that was true. It isn't. Bad stuff will still come around to you eventually. It's just the way of the world. But how you deal with it and the repercussions from it are still up to you. Still up to you. Still totally and completely up to you. How you handle anything that gets in your face has a lot to do with how it leaves you. Whether it leaves you one of those deep, horrible scars that you try to cover with makeup, or it just leaves you with a bump or a bruise that goes away shortly. You see the difference? I hope you see the difference. So when we're talking about the bullies and when we're talking about all the unkindnesses, I do want to pay special attention to cyberbullying, because I agree with all the things that we've read lately, some of the things that Shelley said yesterday. They don't go away. Cyberbullying is dangerous because it's always there. It's there to reread, to reevaluate, to reassess. It's there for us to look at again and again and again and again. You know, I have an office full of memorabilia, and that's why I keep it. Because every now and then I think to myself, you know, why is this happening to me? Why is that happening to me? Why do I always struggle with this? Why do I always struggle with that? And you wonder, you know, what you did, if it's your fault, if it's something that you could have done differently. So I look around when I have days like that and look in my office. And I've talked about this on the air before because of AJ coming in and saying he wants this and he wants that. And right now I'm looking around. I have a plaque that was given to me. We may not have it all together, but together we have it all. I have a best manager ever from your loving staff. I have a book, You'll Always Be My Friend, You Know Too Much. I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. The road to a friend's house is never long. Friendship is a sheltering tree. The essence of true friendship is to make allowances for another's little lapses. But that speaks volumes, doesn't it? It seems to me that trying to live without friends is like milking a bear to get cream for your morning coffee. It is a whole lot of trouble, and then not worth much after you get it. It's all about our choices. It's all about how we feel about the things we do. It's all about how we get to where we want to go, the path that we choose. Successful people live well, laugh often, and love much. They've filled a niche and accomplished tasks so as to leave the world better than they found it, while looking for the best in others and giving the best they have. You know, I hope that by doing this show, even if right now there's only three people listening, and it makes a difference in how they manage the rest of their day, I'll feel good about it. I'll be happy that somebody, instead of walking into work and picking a fight with somebody that they maybe have a little jealousy towards or feel that that other person is trying to hurt them in some way, if they just turn it around on this one day, the repercussions from that positive action will have a positive effect on that person the rest of this day. Now, how small is that? That is so small. And so easy to accomplish. One nice word, one nice comment goes a long way. Sometimes there doesn't even have to be any verbiage. Sometimes it can just be a smile, an action, a grabbing of the door walking into Walmart with the droves of people who will walk right over a small child. Sometimes just that makes a difference in somebody's day. I have Shelley on the line, but she hasn't clicked in for me to let her in. I imagine that's just because she's listening this morning. But I came across in my search last night. Here she is. I'm going to click her in. A story about remember the Corey Feldman and Corey Haim. Most of us remember them from childhood acting days. Good morning, Shelley. She's probably got her phone on mute. No, I lost her completely. Okay, we'll get her back. I read, most of you know that Corey Haim, at a very, very young age, passed away. I think he died of an overdose, as I recall. It was a very sad story. But Corey Feldman, these guys were very close. They were in shows together, movies together, very successful, adorable, both of them, funny, cute, good at what they do. Good morning, Shell. Are you there this time?
Yeah, I've been there all morning. I clicked one. I guess it didn't register. But then when you had to bring me in, I lost my antenna completely, and my phone hung up on it.
Okay. Well, I knew that you were here, but you just hadn't clicked in so that I could open you up. So the story I'm on right now, because I'd like to discuss this, because, of course, it's about people whose life is an open book anyway, and and know who they are. Corey Haim and Corey Feldman. You remember them?
Oh, yeah.
The two young boys, they were in, I don't even remember the names of all the shows they were in, but I think everybody will remember them.
They were from an old movie, Sandlot. Oh, geez, I can't remember the whole name of the movie, but it was an older movie, and they were all like kid actors at the time. And then when they'd grow up to be, And it's a great movie. You know, some of the actors in there went on to be in other regular shows and stuff, but they were all kid actors at the time, the Sandlot kids. I mean, I remember the movie. It was like an adventure movie, you know, based around these kids and, you know. But, yeah, and then as they grew up as adults, they grew up to kind of have troubled lives, these two anyway, the two Corys.
Yeah.
And they did a reality show on them.
They were called a lot of the time the two Corys.
Right, right.
Well,
and
I came across an article. Corey Feldman, he's the surviving Corey, has done what he calls a choreography. I'm going to read it. It's short, but I want people to understand the different things that can happen in a person's life that changes them and makes them into somebody that they didn't start out to be, which is what I truly believe happens to most of our very, very aggressive, very mean and appearance-wise thoughtless people. In many, many cases, they're the softest one in the very beginning. Does that make sense? They're the ones that get hurt the easiest, and they're the ones that end up putting on this this armor that turns them into, you know, I'm going to say something mean about you or do something mean to you before you have the opportunity to do it to me. We see this a lot. We see this aggressiveness because somebody has been hurt. Somebody often has been taken advantage of by an adult in their life. I don't just mean sexually, albeit that is a big part of the damage that gets done to young people. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the repercussions of being introduced to your sexuality before you're ready to deal with it. And we have touched on this before on the show, but it's important, and I have very strong feelings about this. So we're going to talk, I don't know if we'll get to it today, but we are going to talk about this. But let me read this real quick because it is short, but it explains a lot. Now, in his new memoir, Choreography, Corey Feldman details the sexual abuse he and fellow child star Corey Haim endured in Hollywood at the hands of men they worked with and considered friends. Due out October 28th, the book also describes years of drug abuse both he and Haim faced. On the set in 1986 of Lucas, Haim told Feldman that an adult male convinced him that it was perfectly normal for older men and younger boys in the business to have sexual relations, that it was what all the guys do. So they walked off to a secluded area between two trailers, and Haim allowed himself to be sodomized. Feldman wrote per an excerpt obtained by page 6 in the book. After relaying the incident to Feldman, Haim asked, "So I guess we should play around like that too." Feldman dismissed him, saying that that's not what kids do, man. But Feldman went on to suffer abuse himself, specifically by a man named Ron, whom his father hired as his assistant. Ron allegedly took advantage of him after turning him on to drugs. Both Haim and Feldman battled substance abuse issues for years. Feldman, now 42, reached a breaking point when he was arrested for heroin in 1990 at 19 years old. After two more drug arrests, he got sober. Haim was in and out of rehab for addiction 15 times before his death in 2010. Corey was raped at 11, Feldman writes. And like many, many victims, drug use became an easy, if also tragic, way for him to escape the weight of that shame. 2 years before he died, Haim opened up to People magazine about his demons. "I was very, very awake and very ashamed of what was going on. How I put it, I was just coming into Hollywood, man. I was just a horny little kid, like on drugs, getting fed drugs, man, by vampires," he said, of being abused at 14. "I still blame myself to an extent, but my conscience is much, much more clear. I've come to terms with this a long time ago, but obviously not totally. Stuff happens when you are a kid. It scars you inside for life. In 2011, Feldman told Nightline that a Hollywood mogul who abused Haim is to blame for the late actor's life. He said pedophilia and still is Hollywood's biggest problem and darkest secret. So you read a story like this, and we've heard stories like this through the years, different young stars, different female stars, male stars. It's sadly and heartbreakingly way too often, way, way, way too often. And let's say, just for the sake of conversation, that young people who are struggling with the scars that they have acquired in a very short time are making excuses, are saying things that happened so that they have a place to lay the blame other than on themselves. Let's just say, like I said, for the sake of conversation, that's 50% of these kind of stories and these kind of comments. Like I said earlier, if a story like this blooms out of something, it's usually one small seed that happened. One small seed. Now, there could have been just one case of abuse. There could have been just one person that treated them like this. That's possible. And of course, in my heart, I kind of wish that that was true. I do, however, believe that that statement he made at the very end, it is a big part of people's lives now. You read about it way too much. You hear about it way too much. And we see the repercussions in our everyday life. These kind of scenarios, these kind of actions by other adults, the lives of kids, just like the story I told before about the young girl who's living with a stepmother who's abusing her. Very sadly, that's how these things start. It's not just one day some cute little blonde, blue-eyed, little adorable kid decides to go out and start picking on somebody or being mean or being abusive. Something is going on. So when we talk about doing something about bullying, this is like we've talked about so many times, Shelley. In order to fix something, you have to get to the cause, to the beginning, in order to take it away. Otherwise, everything is just a Band-Aid. If you have an infection arm from a wound, before you slap a Band-Aid on it, what do you do? What do you do to fix a bad cut or a boo-boo on your arm? What do you do?
Well, you got to clean it and put some sort of antibiotic on it, some sort of, Neosporin or Calendula or something that's antibiotic, and then put a Band-Aid on it.
But first...
But you got to clean it first.
Right? You got to find out where did that boo-boo come from? Okay. I scraped it. I fell down out in the parking lot walking into Walmart the other day and took the skin right off my elbow. So now I have this hellacious sore elbow. First thing I probably ought to do is, because I slam pretty hard, is make sure that my elbow isn't broken. And once I find out my elbow isn't broken, then I have to, like you just said, I have to clean up the wound. I have to disinfect it. Then I put the Band-Aid on. I don't just stand up and slap a Band-Aid on it, because then what happens? Then underneath the Band-Aid, everything grows, the germs multiply, the bacteria multiplies, and the wound gets horrific. And where does it go? It goes into my bloodstream, right?
Right.
It goes inward. That's what's happening in our lives. These small little things that if we cleaned them up, evaluated them properly, and got rid of them, they wouldn't stay inside of us. Now, that may sound like a silly analogy to somebody. How can you equate a boo-boo on your elbow to being molested by the family friend that comes to the house all the time? How can you equate that? Well, obviously, two different things. Two horrifically indifferent things. The
analogy is accurate, though.
Yes, the repercussions are the same.
That's right.
You end up sick from that damn elbow and infected and with internal stuff going on from anything else that happens to you that you don't evaluate and clean up, whether it's, sometimes it's a word. Sometimes it's, hey, fat ass, get out of my way.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing, right? And some of us would just deal with that and just laugh, you know. What was that saying that I saw on T-shirts a long time ago? And I thought to myself, nobody ever did that to me. I think I talked about this on the show about trying to remember if anybody had ever said anything to me that was hurtful and caused internal damage to me because of the fact that I've been overweight all my life. If they did, I must have swallowed them and then pooped them out or something because they didn't stay with me. But with some people they do, and they harbor hurt and resentment and the repercussions where eventually they have to come out, and they come out in different forms. They come out sometimes in aggressive behavior, moodiness, depression. They come out in all different ways. So
they can also manifest in physical illnesses.
Exactly. Exactly. They can, well, I mean, we discussed recently, I guess it's been quite a while. I was looking through my notes, and do you remember when we were talking about mental illness and all the different kinds of drugs and pharmaceuticals that are used to help people overcome, like, depression or anxiety and all these different things? I came across some information this week in regard to Adderall. Now, Adderall, for a long time, was given to young people to help with ADHD, anxiety, hyperactivity, and Adderall is a drug. I mean, it's not just a natural calming drug like some of the things that are out there. It wasn't designed to take the edge off. It was designed to cover the edge up. Does that make sense?
Well, it's got terrible side effects.
Exactly. And now I find out through some work I'm doing with some other people that young kids, if they had Adderall prescribed to them, they realized that they liked the Adderall euphoria. And now, if they're older and they're still on a script of Adderall, they chew them to make the effects of the Adderall greater. So, again, you know, choices and the repercussions. Here's, you have a child that the teacher says can't stay in school because they disrupt the class every day. And they won't sit in their seat, and I've done everything. I've stood them in the corner. I've sent them to the principal's office. This is very young children, you know, like kindergarten, first grade, second grade. They disrupt the whole class. I can't have them here. Now, this is what brought to light a lot of the original diagnoses of autism and things like that. even though parents realized things were wrong once they put them in a really organized situation like a kindergarten class where everybody has to sit at a table and has to listen to the teacher and all those kind of things, they realized that a child couldn't do that. So way back in the, I want to say the 70s is when it came to light to me, because in the 70s I had all my kids, by the time 73 rolled around, I had all four kids. And there were a lot of kids when they started school in the late 70s that were taking Ritalin and things like that to keep them calm down in kindergarten. And you and I both know at the Institute, we met a lot of those now 40-somethings who were on much heavier pharmaceuticals because that was their life, a pill that kept them in a different place than where they needed to be under normal circumstances or where their body wanted them to be. Consequently, we had a lot of kids from the 70s growing into pill poppers, what everybody refers to as a pill popper, because they can't deal with life any other way.
Right. Right, but they don't even deal with life normally anyway. Even when they're on the drugs, life feels artificial to them. They don't feel that they have the normal range of emotions, so it's frustrating. They can't come off because they can't function, but while they're on it, they're still suffering. And that's the tragedy of it, is that, like you said, it sets them off on this vicious cycle. And I've told the story on the show a couple of times of my nephew who had been deemed, that's when he was a little boy, I think he was 8 years old, and so it's that second grade, I guess. And they had sent notices home to my sister that he was incorrigible, that he would not listen, he wouldn't sit down, blah, blah, blah. Nina took him to a pediatrician, and surprisingly enough, I mean, we're going back 30 years, surprisingly mm-hmm. enough, she took him to a pediatrician who understood nutrition. And instead of suggesting some sort of medication, he told my sister to clean up his diet, to take all sugar, preservatives, and food, anything that was packaged. And he said, feed him no prepackaged food. My sister did that, and literally within a few days, not a few weeks, a few days, his behavior was markedly improved. The teachers called my sister. They couldn't believe the change in him. He was calm. He sat through class. He was okay. And then my brother-in-law, who didn't believe in any of it, he wasn't there often enough to really see the change in his behavior. So he just thought that it was cruel not to allow him to have his Twinkies or whatever. So he brought him home a package of, I think it was Twinkies or Devil Dogs or something, it was something sweet. And mm-hmm. he gave Derek one. Now, he had been on a clean diet for 2 weeks. So this was like going into a drug addict and giving them their normal amount after they've been clean for 6 months. He had like an overdose reaction to this 120, and this kid went nuts. He became so agitated and so like stressed out and strung out just from the sugar from 120 that he went over to, and I was living there at the time, he went over to the hallway and he started banging his forehead on the wall saying, what's wrong with me? I feel like I'm coming apart. And he banged his head so hard by the time we got over to him that he actually made his forehead bleed. And this was from the sugar from 150 after he had been on a clean diet. So it shows how dramatically the chemicals in foods and the sugar spikes in foods can impact a child's behavior. So behavioral problems, especially in young kids when their bodies are developing, are very, very much affected by preservatives, food dyes, anything that's artificial in foods, sugars, things like that. This can absolutely make children spacey, hyperactive, can make them disobedient, all right, because their mind's racing. They're just not listening. It's not that they're not listening to you because they're not good kids. They're not listening to you because they have no focus at that point. They're on this, like, sugar rush that's making them act out in a way that's not okay. But if someone were just to control their diet a little bit, they would find that the child would behave better. So a lot of behavioral problems are really dietary issues. And it's a tragedy that more and more parents aren't taught this, instead of medicating their kids just to clean up their diet a little bit. And I have the same issue with a cousin of mine. He was actually put in an institution when he was a kid, and they found out when he became an adult that he had severe food allergies, and particular foods would, like, set him off. And by the time they found out that he had already been institutionalized for 4 years, it was a terrible tragedy. And then once they found out, you know, what he was allergic to, and they cleaned up his diet, he became a very functional adult, but he had all these emotional scars from being treated as a bad kid for most of his life. And as soon as he cleaned up his own diet, he had a much better life, but he had a very sad, he had sad memories because of how badly he was treated by people in authority thinking he was a bad kid when he really wasn't.
Well, and I think the week that we did so much on mental illness, we found out a lot of times that things like that had happened. And, of course, this all has to do, again, with some very simple things that people should do, and that's to evaluate everything and not just take a person along with an answer, accept that for the truth or the right answer. You can't do that. You need to really, it's like what I just said about cleaning up and investigating what's really wrong before you just slap a Band-Aid on something. And that's what they did in the 70s. Somebody realized that there was severe hyperactivity. Now, let's remember, too, the 70s was a time when a lot of partying, a lot of partying. It was the hippie era. It was when people drank and smoked weed to excess from 16 to 30. The lifestyle was one of peace and love and being mellow. Mellow was a favorite word back in those days. And it led to a lot of very dysfunctional, albeit happy, behavior. And I think that then when children were born from that era, then that's when we started seeing all of these behavioral problems to such a high degree. Not that they weren't around before, because they were. We read stories about that when we talked about mental illness going way back to the 1800s. If a, you know, behavior of somebody, if it was different than everybody else, they were smacked right into a mental institute. So we know that all these kind of things were happening at a great degree. But I do believe that there's some, there's some links involved with the behavior in the 70s to the fact that by the late 70s, early 80s, that's when I had three or four friends in the early 80s and the late 70s who had five-year-olds on Ritalin. Several friends that I can think of right sitting here without even giving it a whole lot of thought. So it was, you know, again, repercussions from our actions, repercussions from our actions. And what's going to happen in the days to come, I don't know, unless people start getting a handle on our innovative procedures for preparing food. As a for instance, like what you just said, you know, there's good food and there's bad food out there. You read all of the ingredients on a box of soup. Shelley and I went to a restaurant recently with some friends from out of town.
Yeah.
And Shelley is a very strict vegetarian, borderline vegan, I am a vegetarian, and just within the past year, I've added fish back into my diet because I was, I no longer have access to all the wonderful greens that I do believe in. I'm too lazy to have a garden, and I am not in a position to go out or have delivered all the greens that I know I should be taking. I mean, I eat a lot of greens, but I didn't think I was getting enough. So I added in fish, plus that I missed the texture of fish. I will never eat red meat, chicken, pork, any of those things again. But I added in fish. So in, and I mostly eat salmon. So we're in this restaurant. A restaurant that we've gone before in the last 10, 12 years because they prepared foods in a way that was acceptable to the lifestyle that we believe in. And now they have an allergy menu. And even, now listen to this, their spinach dip has shellfish in it. And what else was in it, Shelley? Shellfish and fish, both in the spinach dip?
Yeah, there's some sort of fish additives or whatever, but the one that got me the most was the black bean burger. Most vegetarians go out and feel safe ordering a black bean burger because you think that would be vegetarian-friendly. Why would you have a black bean burger on your menu with all your other hamburgers and not have it be vegetarian, but there's shellfish and fish ingredients in it? So I wasn't able to have it. I was shocked. You know, and I had actually ordered the black bean burger there another time, you know, and I was like, all right, great, they still have the black bean burger. But then when I got the allergy menu, and actually we were looking for an ingredient in something else, and I noticed the two fish emblems, and I asked them, and I forgot what the ingredient was, but it's fish-derived, and I was like, wow. I said, well, that's not even vegetarian anymore. I said, what do they think? And I'm trying to think in my head why a manufacturer would even put those ingredients in to a black bean burger. It's just, like, ludicrous. Do they not understand the concept of vegetarianism, you know? But, yeah,
well,
so it's a little disappointing to me.
It's mass production, so there must be a way to save money or make more or something. It must have something to do with the monetary.
Yeah, they're using ingredients from something else they make that's already got the fish in it, and like you said, just to save money. I mean, that does make sense, but it's also not appropriate. Because I'm telling you, most vegetarians will go to that restaurant, get the black bean burger, and if they're a true vegetarian like I am, it is not the choice they would make if they understood that those ingredients were in there. So, you know, I find it a little deceptive practices. It was kind of upsetting.
Well, and the point is, though, I will say one thing for this restaurant. At least they provide that information. There's probably a lot of other restaurants out there that are deceptive about it. So,
but they only provided it because they asked for it. It wasn't on the regular menu.
They have to let you know
what common allergens are in something. So when I asked for the allergy menu, they gave it to me, but it's not on the regular menu. So if I didn't think of asking that, I never would have found out. But I understand what you're saying, but at least they have that prepared and they were able to give it to me. But if you ask any restaurant within the food, they have to tell you.
Yeah, but the hard part about that, and we've talked about this before, in most cases, the waiter or waitress doesn't have a clue what's in the food.
I was trying to buy pet food the other day. I told you about this. I was shocked. The two different salespeople, my dog has to be on grain-free dog food. This woman's telling me, oh, buy this brand, there's no grains in it, and I'm looking on it, and the first ingredient, it's made with brown rice and chicken or something like that. I said, honey, I said, it's got brown rice in it. That's a grain. No, all of this line is all grain-free. I said, it doesn't say grain-free on the bag. And I said, brown rice is a grain. I said, you can't tell people something like that if you don't know what you're talking about. I was actually a little annoyed with her. So the kid comes over, the younger man who was there, and he picks up another bag of dog food that actually said grain-free on it, incidentally. And he says, oh, well, you can't get this one either then. It's got peas in it. I was like, oh, my God. I said, guys, peas. I said, listen to me. I said, you need to understand nutrition if you're going to try to counsel customers. Brown rice is a grain. Peas are not a grain. So I said, you're telling me to buy a bag of dog food that would hurt my dog, and you're telling me not to buy a bag of dog food that would be fine for him. And I was like flabbergasted that these were the two people that were in the store that day to help me, and neither one of them knew what they were talking about.
Well, that's a whole other show, you know, and of course that goes back to we've done about training and being knowing that somebody knows what, you know, well, that could get so deep. I can't even imagine. If you walk into almost any restaurant, I can't think of any. Years ago, I applied for a job many, many, many years ago, a very, very high-end French restaurant, and I do not speak French. I had no idea that when I walked in the door, I thought, oh, how pretty, you know, and everything was so nice, and it smelled so good, and it was just, I thought, oh, this will be so nice to work here. I was in my 20s. And the guy says to me, what wine would you tell everybody to have with fish Florentine or something like that? And I said, white wine. And he said, what kind of white wine? A dry wine, a sweet wine? I said, I have no clue. Then he asked me all the different ingredients in all the French sauces. I had no idea. I looked at him and I said, I guess I can't work here because I don't. He said, you could study and I could give you something to read about all of our food and what's in it and what isn't in it and everything. And I thought to myself, you know, I would do that. I really would do that. But then he told me I had to learn how to say a lot of the words properly in French. And I thought, this isn't worth it to me. But I loved the fact that that's the only way I would have been acceptable to work there. I thought
right.
to myself, no wonder they're so successful and this is so beautiful because they have ground rules. They're not going to take some young girl. I could be the best waitress in the world. But if I don't know, like you just said, if I don't know that eggs are in something when somebody's allergic to eggs, I'm a danger.
That's right.
I'm really, and there's not a lot of thought put into that these days, except in your real, real high-end restaurants. And forget fast food restaurants and frozen food and prepared food for a lot of people is not good for you. MSG, just for starters, has caused more illness than any one other preservative I can think of off the top of my head. And that very possibly that's not true. But for me, every time I turn around, somebody talks to me about an episode that they had because they ate too much MSG. And, of course, there for a while.
To be honest with you, I don't understand why MSG hasn't been outlawed because there are, I would say, the majority of people have sensitivity to it. It can cause brain fog. It can cause anger. It can cause like allergy type hives and things like on the body. If I eat anything with MSG in it, I get such an overwhelming headache. So I'm very sensitive to look for that. But that's a very dangerous ingredient.
Yeah, it is. It's a toughie. So we're out of time, but we went on quite a spiral and MSG from all the things I started talking about. But again, I guess the biggest lesson you can take from today is choices. The choices are yours, no one else's. So make good ones. Make ones that don't leave you with all kinds of repercussions. So everybody go out there today and make it a great day. It's Tuesday, and tomorrow I'm hoping to have a guest this week in regard to celebration of anti-bullying, but I've been unable to reach them. But we're going to work on that, and we have a lot more stories to talk about. So everybody go out there and have a great one. God bless. We'll be back tomorrow morning. Bye, Shell. Thanks, honey.
Bye, Reen. Everyone have a great day.